You're listening to Stoppe on Radio Statler. I have with me Mr. Robert Steele. Now, I'd like to spend some time discussing the open source intelligence movement that you're a part of. But first, I'd like to touch a little bit on your background. So, I mean, if we quickly look at your bio, you spent some time in the Marines. You're an operative in the CIA. You were involved with the Marines, the Marine Corps Intelligence Center. Could you touch a little bit on those specific aspects of your life? Like, what were you doing while you were involved with those?
I grew up as the son of an oil man, mm-hmm. An oil engineer overseas. So I grew up learning how to think and experiencing the diversity of life that is overseas. I got a master's in international relations, did a thesis on predicting revolution, and decided I'd become overly academic, overly educated. So I joined the Marine Corps to gain some rough edges.
Okay.
And that worked. I was an infantry officer.
What in particular, like, if you spend all, you said you went up to a master's degree before you entered the Marines?
Yes, I did.
So what made you go from, like, an academic aspect of your life to something where a little more, I guess, pedestrian? I don't know what you'd call that.
Pedestrian as much as, I mean, if you think between the mind and the body, I have a high IQ. I was very educated. I subsequently got two more masters, one master's and a Naval War College diploma. The Marine Corps for me was the logical opposite of being an intellectual.
Okay.
And I will have to tell you that actually Marines are very smart. They're not jarheads, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
They're much, much smarter than people realize. It takes a very, very unusual kind of person to forego the luxurious existence that the U.S. Army enjoys and actually be part of the very austere Marine Corps.
So now, was this were you seeking adventure? Like what in particular drove you to make that switch?
I basically wanted to move into a culture that was all about physical fitness and all about being able to operate in austere and dangerous environments.
Okay.
And so that was it. That was it. There was no real rah-rah, you know, go kill foreigners motivation there. Mm-hmm. It was strictly about moving into another culture.
Okay.
And then I found that culture boring because it was in peacetime. So I joined the Central Intelligence Agency, and I did that because the world of secrecy was about as far away from everything I understood. In other words, it was about finding new experiences.
Now, I was reading your bios. I don't recall exactly where, but some of like your non-degree training, and I just wanted to mention some things. Some of the I guess their courses, I don't really know how it works in the military, but commercial intelligence, field station management, cryptology, clandestine operations. Like, is that something that you particularly drove yourself towards, or did the Marines notice something in you where they felt like that was a good direction for you to go in?
No, first off, the Marine Corps, the training the Marine Corps gave me was in infantry.
Okay.
In moving men and machines across hostile terrain.
So more logistics?
No, combat.
Okay.
But the CIA is really, there's actually, I've published a post on seven CIAs. It's many different little CIAs, but the clandestine human CIA is about recruiting people to be traitors.
Mm-hmm.
And so the basic proposition is, I'll give you money if you'll violate every oath you ever took and help me do things that are completely against the interests of your country, your organization, your culture, and your family. That's what clandestine case officers do.
Okay.
That for me was simply an exciting, interesting look into the belly of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
And that was its greatest value to me, because today, as I'm a champion of the Open Source Everything Manifesto, I have the unique background of having been on the other side of the empire, on the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understand every aspect and intimate detail of the dark side, and I particularly understand that it's not worth what we're paying for it.
Could you go a bit more into that?
Well, General Tony Zinni, who was then the combatant commander of the Central Command, is on record as saying that as the commander of the Central Command, which was in two wars and had about 12 actions, he received from secret sources and methods at best, I quote him, at best 4% of what he needed to know.
Okay.
So we're paying $80 billion a year, and the best that we can do is give General Zinni 4% of what he needs to know to run two wars and 12 minor actions.
Where does the rest of the information come from, that other 96%?
Either he doesn't have it, mm-hmm. or he goes after it directly from open sources. But that consumes his time, and he doesn't have the existing sources and methods. The, you know, it's think of it as the secret world is as if we have built a superhighway between Washington and Moscow, and we've got a couple of Cadillacs called satellites that go back and forth, and we've got some very, very expensive human spies, but not really that many. Okay, now, let me finish my analogy. What we actually need to understand the real world, instead of a superhighway between Moscow and Washington, what we actually need is 100 Jeeps, 1,000 motorcycles, 10,000 bicycles, and 1,000,000 pedestrians. That's the difference between the open source world and the secret world.
Okay.
The secret world is the Cadillac on that single superhighway that's useless off the road.
Now, when you say, like, very expensive, typically to obtain and keep an operative from another like organization, a government, whatever, like what type of like monetary amounts are involved with that?
The average, remembering that this is a very part-time job.
Yeah.
The average monthly salary is anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000
okay.
a month. Now, I'm out of date. I haven't been a real spy since 1988.
Okay.
But I understand from Jack Devine's new book, Good Hunting, A Spymaster's Story, he was the top spy at CIA. He was also one of my rabbis. And his book confirms that $1,000 is still pretty much the starting point for a salary. Now, for $1,000, you want someone to meet with you once a month, maybe twice a month, and maintain clandestine communications or be able to provide secret information twice a month. So their total time outlay in terms of dedicated time is on the order of 4 to 6 hours.
Okay, I could see how on an individual basis it doesn't seem like much, but when you're talking about, like, I would assume tens of thousands of operatives worldwide, like that exponentially goes up.
No, you would be very surprised, because in fact, the dirty little secret of the Central Intelligence Agency is it doesn't do much spying.
Really?
We have a clandestine service,
mm-hmm.
and your average case officer recruits one person a year. I was recruiting 5 a year.
Okay.
These people are generally low rent. They don't actually provide very much information. 90% of the so-called secrets from CIA are handed to them by their intelligence counterpart in the country that they're supposed to be spying on.
Okay.
Or they come from legal traveler debriefings here in the United States from the National Collection Division. So not secret.
So they're getting, you say they're getting information from their counterparts. Is it like a quid pro quo? Like they're telling us stuff so that we tell them stuff? Or
in fact, they're telling us what they want us to know.
Okay.
One of the reasons we've been such a failure in Afghanistan is because 90% of our knowledge has come from Pakistan.
Okay.
And Pakistan thinks of us as useful idiots with rich, deep pockets. Okay. In fact, Bruce Rydell has a new book out or something on how we've been the quartermaster of the Afghan war. We've basically thrown money at the problem, not intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now this is what you would consider, like, I guess, closed source intelligence. Now, in terms of like open source intelligence, you were saying like Jeeps and bicycles and pedestrians.
Anything that is legally and ethically available. One of the problems that we have is that our intelligence community, for example, let's take the Middle East. There are roughly 1,400 professors teaching Middle Eastern matters in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget what the exact number is, but at one point in time, CIA was talking to 14 of them, because those were the 14 that were U.S. citizens who could qualify for top secret clearances.
Okay.
All right. We have a real aversion unless you're paying money and treating someone as a traitor, we have a real aversion to actually talking to foreigners and listening to foreigners in an open way.
Is it that they find free information isn't as valuable to them?
That's the standard answer, is they don't consider free information to be valuable. Mm-hmm. But in fact, most information that we pay for is false to begin with.
Okay.
It's fabricated. It's manipulated. It's misrepresentative. So what we're actually doing is we're spending money. And by the way, spies are a drop in the bucket. The real money is being spent on imagery intelligence and signals intelligence, like NSA's mass surveillance of U.S. citizens. That's where all the money really goes. Now, the dirty secret there is that they process less than 1% of it. And I think it was Binney speaking here at Hackers 2 or 4 years ago who said, NSA is not in the business of producing intelligence. It's in the business of money moving. It's in the business of spending money. It's not in the business of actually doing signals intelligence.
So basically they're obtaining all this information and then sitting on it?
They're sitting on it, but the primary purpose of NSA is to spend large amounts of money on U.S. contractors.
Okay.
Who then have a 5% kickback to Congress on every program that is funded.
So from like an open source movement, could you just go a bit more in detail in terms of like where this information would go? How would you process
it? Sure. And let me start with a tiny URL.
Okay.
At tinyurl.OSE-2014. So OSE, like open source everything, OSE in capital letters, -2014. So that's a tiny URL, tinyurl.OSE-2014, and then OSE-2014. I have the lecture that I gave at Liberation Technology here in New York City about a month ago. I gave a PowerPoint briefing on the Open Source Everything Manifesto.
Okay.
Of course, I've written the book, and the book is free at Pirate Bay right now, but I also have extracts from the book that are free, and all of that is at this tiny URL that I've just given you. Now, a lot of people understand open source software,
sure.
Open source hardware, open data, open government. Those are pretty much the four standards. Mm-hmm. Okay. In fact, open source everything means just that, open source everything. So you start with open BTS, open base transceiver station. Burning Man had 10,000 people in the middle of nowhere with free cellular telecommunications using an open base transceiver station.
Okay.
And you go through open cloud, open data, open government, open software, open hardware. A lot of governments have realized now that open data means nothing and open government means nothing if you still have to buy Microsoft in order to interact with that data. You have open spectrum. You have the whole issue of dark fiber and free Wi-Fi, which ought to be a public service rather than something you have to pay for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, free Wi-Fi for me is like the air that we breathe. It needs to be a public good because that's how people are educated and stay in touch and are engaged as citizens and so forth. So one of the concepts that's in this book is the whole idea that an open source ecology has to be like a living whole system. It's not good enough to have open source software. You have to have open source hardware to go with that open source software. And the reason you need all of these opens is because that's the only way you can get everybody. Remember, it's not just the 1 billion rich we're thinking about, it's the 5 billion poor. Open source is the only solution to any problem that is affordable, interoperable, and globally scalable. All of these other proprietary solutions are not affordable, not interoperable, and not globally scalable. They also fail to provide for what's called true cost economics. For example, Jay-Z Liskowitz did a study of a standard cotton t-shirt, and this was briefed at HOPE several years ago. A standard cotton t-shirt contains gallons of water that have been used from the growing of the cotton all the way through to the manufacturing process, all the way through to the cleansing, and then the shop cleaning and so forth. They have 17 grams of fuel in them. Grams was the measure that Jay-Z had to use to distinguish between gallons and other things. They have child labor involved in them. A lot of these cotton t-shirts have actually been created by children, child slaves. They have tax avoidance. They have toxins. There are a whole bunch of toxins that are associated with getting a cotton t-shirt from the growing of the cotton through the chemicalization in the factory all the way to the sale in the store. Mm-hmm. So when you look at something and you can see the true cost of that in all possible terms, now you're an informed, engaged citizen. And so the open source ecology is intended to essentially empower all citizens and restore public agency and get every citizen to the point that they know as much or more about any product, service, policy, or behavior than the organizations fostering them.
I feel like you're putting a lot of faith in the citizens themselves, where I think that we found that when people act in mass, they might not necessarily act in their own best interest. And to also touch on the same thing, the gap in information, the difference between having a lot of information and not so much, seems to be where a lot of the power is derived from. So if you were to put the citizens on the same footing as, let's say, government, one, how can you trust the citizens to interpolate and act on that data in the right way? And then two, from a governmental standpoint, like, are secrets needed? Like, is there something in terms of intelligence where it doesn't benefit the whole if they know?
That's an utterly brilliant challenge, and it's the kind of question that I need to get more often and mm-hmm. that I need to answer. Let me take it in separate steps. First off, I love the Linux line. If you put enough eyeballs on it, no bug is invisible. Well, the same line holds true in Wisdom of the Crowds. And Tom Attlee, I'm the president of the Tom Attlee fan club. He wrote Tao of Democracy and Evolutionary Activism, and most recently he's written a book on public wisdom. And Tom Attlee has taught me that the wisdom of the crowds is not the same as collective wisdom or collective intelligence. You're absolutely right. Mobs can move or be useless. Occupy was a wonderfully inspired, useless mob because they refused to take the one step they could have taken, which is to occupy the home offices of every senator and representative until we had an Electoral Reform Act. Mm-hmm. That was what I tried to get them to do. What we're really talking about here is ensuring that all of the relevant information is on the table. You've spoken about information asymmetries. And one of the flaws in free market and the economic principles that we live by today is that it is assumed that the buyer and the seller have equal positions in terms of information. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely untrue.
Yeah.
Goldman Sachs will sell you Facebook, and they'll make their money in the friends and family phrase, and then they'll dump all the risk on the public. And they will not share all of the information that they have.
The brokers actually have a term for that. It's called ripping one's face off, where they have no problem selling worthless assets.
You're absolutely right. And Mark Lewis wrote a book called Liar's Poker in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And Lewis was interviewed recently. He's written several other excellent books, including this most recent one about flash trading. And Lewis was asked about his book in the 1980s, and he said, you know, the one thing that surprised me is that they're still getting away with it.
Yeah.
The fact is the government is complicit. Now, I would mention Matt Taibbi's book, Griftopia. There's an absolutely brilliant quote on page 32 of Griftopia. And I write summary reviews. I'm the number one Amazon reviewer for nonfiction. I read in 98 categories. Mm-hmm. This is how I keep myself sane. Taibbi talks about how there's been a merger between a corrupt government and a corrupt banking industry. And essentially, the U.S. government is not regulating the banking industry for us. They're regulating the banking industry so Bill Clinton can take his multi-billion dollar payout after being president. And Rubin can get his multi-billion dollar payout for having essentially screwed the American economy while he was Secretary of the Treasury. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to ask myself, and I'm not a vindictive person. I believe in truth and reconciliation. I don't believe in going after vindictive justice. But I have to ask myself, how is it possible that the American public still doesn't get it? And one of the things that keeps coming up is the fact that the media is part of the problem. The Wall Street Journal, the New York Times are absolutely worthless in relation to providing useful information to the public. They're essentially a comic book service. And that strikes me as a real tragedy. So coming to your point about the average person not being empowered, one of the things that I would like to try and do with the open source everything movement is get to the point where the average American is fully educated, fully engaged, and will not tolerate corruption at any level. One of the things I learned from a great book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, is that corruption is at the local level and the state level, not just the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Rotary Club, the Kiwanis Club. It's all these people who are part of the City Planning Commission, who give tax breaks to corporations, who waive pollution constraints. And essentially, they do that to get their commissions. So they get theirs, and they screw the public. And so I want to see a public that is essentially, as I told hackers and as I told Gnomedex in Seattle in 2007, I want us to be on every piece of public business like leeches and absolutely let no act of corruption go unnoticed.
Okay. So along those lines, I just want to touch on, you mentioned that the media in general. Now, I guess it's going back, and I'm dating myself a bit with Chomsky and, I believe, Manufacturing Dissent.
Consent.
Yes. Consent. When a vast majority of the media is owned by a very small portion of the population, in fact, just recently with Time Warner trying to obtain...
It doesn't matter. Fox. It's five major corporations.
Yeah. So, I mean, then you're talking about even less, so that the outlets in terms of news that you have left are public-funded news, like NPR.
Even NPR is corrupt. Mm-hmm. Otto Reich, when he was in power in the U.S. government, was basically censoring NPR, and he was forcing them to move away from certain stories and to manipulate certain stories.
Is there a particular news service that you hold above others?
The short answer is no. I've even found Reuters and the Associated Press to be corrupt. Mm-hmm. And it really depends on the story.
Yeah.
It depends on the personalities. It depends on the political moment. But the bottom line, I mean, The Guardian seems to be doing pretty well. But by and large, there is no... First off, I don't think there's a corporate solution for the media. I believe the media has to be of, by, and for the public.
Like in a similar way to the BBC, where it's government-funded?
Well, BBC now means buggering British children. I mean, they're at the center of a major pedophile scandal, which is coming to New York City soon.
Mm-hmm.
When pedophilia from Boston to New York to Washington is truly understood by the public, that will be the day we have a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the last taboo. That's the last big denial. That's the last thing most people are absolutely unwilling to contemplate, that there is a child slavery network in this country, and that when children reach the end of their useful slave life, they are killed and they get away with it. Okay, this is horrible stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line here is, I think communities now need to manage their own media.
Okay.
I really liked Patch.com. It was a good idea,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't really take off.
So kind of like this, like ultra local, where the people who had a vested interest in the community are presenting the news.
Now you're asking very, very good questions, and these are the conversations that I think people should be having at the local level. I'm not talking about vested interest presenting the news as much as I'm talking about making sure that all the news that you need. I mean, the difference between news and intelligence is that intelligence actually tries to answer a specific question.
Mm-hmm.
I've always said that information and news costs money and intelligence makes money.
Okay.
So for example, fracking. In terms of fracking, the news can present all the bad things, like it contaminates aquifers, it causes earthquakes. Intelligence can tell you that this purchase of agricultural land by this front company is intended to lead to fracking.
Okay.
All right? And so you end up getting a kind of preventive measures focus there. I don't have all the answers, but I will say that what I am finding is that every form of organization that causes a distance to emerge between citizens, information, and decisions is toxic.
Mm-hmm. So sort of along the lines of like power corrupting?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I would like to say I'm not in favor of anarchy, but I am in favor of panarchy. Panarchy is engaged, informed citizens who are respectful of one another, who actually engage in what the Native American population used to do.
So would that be almost returning into like city state type governments where...
Direct democracy, yes.
So with direct democracy, though, how do you operate on a global level?
all of the direct. One of the things that I would like to see, and my friend Predrag, not Predrag Pale, he's a Croatian vice minister, Parag Khanna has talked about the emergence of city-states, and Singapore is a very good example. The City of London and New York City are other examples. What I think is happening in the United States today is that the federal government has reached its maximum Peter principle of incompetence.
Okay.
And every decision being made within the federal government is being made on the basis of insufficient information and is overly corrupted by religious, ideological, or financial concerns. So what we're doing today with our military is wasting vast amounts of citizen money on things that don't work. Mm-hmm. The F-35 and the F-32, for example, are, as far as I'm concerned, treason against the Republic. There is no reason why those two airplanes should be funded nor flown.
No. I mean, like, just from that standpoint, you look at the United States from a technological standpoint is head and shoulders above the rest. The jets that we sell other countries have no comparison to what we currently fly. Like, they shoot rockets, we could just outrun them. Like, why do we need something better? But to play devil's advocate, it's not that that money is lost. It's not like you're using multi-million dollar rockets to blow up mud huts. You're investing in technology and infrastructure that gets returned to the economy.
I think Obama has a job for you in his press office. because in fact, most of that money does not translate into salaries for U.S. citizens. Most of that money translates into profit-taking by banks and corporations and overhead expenses.
So how is this different from, let's say, the space race where you could directly see that for every, and I'm off with dollar amounts, but I know that, let's say, for every $10 NASA spent, 13 came back in the economy because of technological advancements.
One of the things that has changed is that there was a time when the government would pay for quality engineering. Today, the government pays for what my friend Chuck Spinney calls government specs cost plus engineering.
Okay.
This is shitty engineering. It is bad, bad engineering. It's basically engineering that is designed to cost the government as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not elegant engineering. It's not resilient, sustainable engineering. So I think if you really compare the past to the present, the whole engineering culture has changed. And instead of fostering good engineering that has peaceful applications, what we're fostering is bad engineering that reaches a dead end. Mm-hmm. I mean, the F-20, the F-35, whichever one is the stealth jet, is killing pilots.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's too powerful for the people that are flying.
The toxins that are in the stealth chemistry are killing pirates. It's depriving them of oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So no one actually thought about the true cost of stealth technology that is toxic to human beings. This is what I mean about needing to get all the information on the table. Also, in D-Day, I seem to recall that on D-Day plus two, we lost 1,600 tanks.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have numbers. We don't have a concept for a military in which we can afford to lose a great many of our platforms.
Well, is that just because as a culture we've come more risk adverse? Like for D-Day, for instance, like I in the first day or so we lost about 4,500 people just storming the beach. Which is a very small number if you think about it. I recall reading a documentary where they were interviewing people on both sides, and the Americans storming the beach were like, we saw the fortifications, and they said they had no idea how they would take it. And then the Germans, looking out from their bunkers, saw basically ships to the horizon and said, there's no way we could defend this. But back then, and maybe this more has to do with the fact that people aren't used to losing children, but...
Well, actually, I want the universal draft restored.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is happening right now is we're going to wars because the middle class is not objecting. And the middle class is not objecting
because the poorest
sons and daughters are not.
It's the poorest portion of the population. It's socioeconomical now.
There's a wonderful DVD called Why We Fight.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one called The Good Soldier. And I've reviewed both of them at Amazon. What we have right now is excessive reliance on spending money for technology that does not work as advertised. There's a gunnery sergeant, Poole, Gunny Poole has written a wonderful series of books, including A Private's Guide to Survival and The Eastern Art of Warfare and things like this. And one of the things that he points out is that the Vietnamese beat us with all of our technology because they had individuals that were willing to take an entire night to go 15 meters in order to plant a bomb. And our technology couldn't detect those people and stop them. All right. So we have lost respect for the human factor. And we have...
I would completely disagree. I feel that the cost that it takes to train a soldier and the equipment that we spend makes soldiers much more expensive. And, like, let's be honest. Let's say between Iraq and Afghanistan, let's say 6,500 troops we've lost. That's less people than get killed crossing streets, not in crosswalks.
Yes, but we also lost both those wars. And let me point out to you, General Robert Scales has actually done the numbers. The infantry costs us 1% of the Pentagon budget. This is 4% of the force. It takes 80% of the casualties, and it receives 1% of the Pentagon's budget. We are spending all of our money on corporations and technologies. We are not spending our money actually training human beings to be really excellent.
I feel like you're putting the human beings on a pedestal, and I know that sounds shallow.
Actually, I like the sound of that.
But I feel like you're putting them on a pedestal, and from a military standpoint, like one death is very tragic. Like, I feel bad for that person to die, but 6,500 is just a number. And if it takes 6,500 people to achieve what we need to achieve, in the grand scheme of things, in terms of Vietnam or World War II, 6,500 doesn't seem like that large of a number.
It's not, but you know, I think of things in complicated ways. And when I think about Iraq, I think about the 935 lies that Dick Cheney led the telling of, which ultimately cost the taxpayer not only those 6,500 people, but the travesty called Fallujah. We now have mutant babies being born every day in Fallujah because of the depleted uranium and all the chemicals that we put down. We have over 75,000 amputees in the United States of America. And the Pentagon does everything it can to hide those amputees from the U.S. public. Okay, that's a travesty. We basically destroyed an entire generation of young men for the wrong reasons. All right. I then think about all of the contractors and how we're outsourcing war. And essentially, we're making it profitable for contractors like Blackwater. It can change its name all at once. It will always be Blackwater.
Sure.
We're making it profitable for contractors like Blackwater to bribe congressmen to vote for war authorizations that are absolutely against the best interests of the United States of America and of the U.S. public. And I think one of the things that troubles me most as an intelligence professional is that the public has completely disengaged from its own governance. We're not keeping our government honest, and our government is uninformed and very, very ineffective.
I want to ask a question in two parts. One, was the American public ever informed, like let's say you go back 50 years, and then two, what would it take to change that?
You know, that's a question that I actually live with every single day. And I was deeply inspired by Will Durant's 1916 thesis, his doctoral thesis. Will Durant is the guy who, with Ariel Durant, wrote the 11-volume Story of Civilization. And then he wrote a capstone book called The Lessons of History. One of the lessons of history is that morality is a strategic asset of priceless value. The United States is no longer respected around the world because it has lost its moral standing. But... In his thesis, which has been published recently as what is it called now? Philosophy and the Social Problem, I think it is, the annotated edition. In his thesis, he comes to the conclusion that the sole primary purpose of good governance is to educate the public and get out of the way. And instead, what we have is a government that is micromanaging everything. Our education today is abysmal. I was a substitute teacher in Fairfax County, and I was shocked at the degree to which we're teaching trash. The history books are written by the victors, and so, of course, we don't teach that we invaded Mexico. We teach that there was a Mexican-American War in which we were victorious and the Alamo held off 5,000 people, never mind that we were, in fact, invading Mexico.
Sure. There's tons of things they leave out. In the late 1800s, how basically senators would overthrow South American governments. Like,
still today, we are best pals with 42 of the 44 dictators on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of U.S. government policy, we support 42 out of 44 dictators. The only two we don't like are North Korea and Cuba. I think that's wrong.
But so how is now different than, let's say, the 1950s or 60s, where people would say, like, this golden age of peace, I would guess?
Well, one of the things that I like about the 1950s, apart from the whole cultural idea of my three sons being obedient and well-groomed and so forth, is our high school graduates in the 1950s knew as much as our college graduates today.
See, I don't necessarily know if I agree with that, because you have fourth grade students learning algebra, where 10 years ago, that wasn't something I learned until eighth or ninth
grade.
But
that's a rarity.
I mean, perhaps from the better school districts, but I feel that while standardized testing, you're losing certain aspects of the curriculum, critical thinking and definitely
you're
history.
You're wiping
and science.
Out art. You're wiping out music. You're wiping out all creative things that sponsor innovation.
Sure, without a doubt. But like, let's say, like, in the 50s, like, you went through high school and a high school degree was enough to get you a job working in a factory, whereas now you need a lot more in terms of education and...
It's worse than that. One of the dirty little secrets, apart from the fact that the government lies about everything, mm-hmm. is that the real unemployment rate in the United States of America today is closer to 22%.
Oh, much higher.
22%. And here you have the government saying 6 or 7%, and the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, corrupt to the bone, both of them, are saying, yeah, 6%, great, we're doing great. There isn't anybody with integrity at either of those two newspapers.
I know if you include incarcerated males, the unemployment rate, I think, for African Americans is over 35%.
That's a lovely, lovely point, because that also plays to the point that we have a prison industry that is bribing judges to convict kids so that they can go become slaves.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great little book called Nobody's, and it's about slavery in the United States today. And we have three forms of slavery. We have prison slavery. We have Hispanic farm laborer slavery, particularly some of these vast farms in the Everglades in Florida, where they're basically out in the middle of nowhere, and then there are guards and dogs and guns to keep them there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you have the sex and the Chinese seamstress slavery in the United States. And the U.S. government is doing nothing about it. It is totally complicit in these crimes against humanity.
So how do we fix it?
That's a good question, because Occupy was a big disappointment for me. I saw Occupy as a populist movement with enormous potential.
I feel that they didn't learn the lessons that the civil rights movement did.
Excellent point.
And because of that, their desire to not have a hierarchy, things along those lines. I don't want to be as superficial as to say dress, but the fact that they came off as unemployed high school hippie or college dropout hippies instead of productive members of society who want change.
There's good
that's
and bad.
What
I mean, one of the things that troubles me, and Chomsky points this out in one of his recent books, is over 7,000 Occupy protesters went to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody from Goldman Sachs has gone to jail yet.
No.
And so the government is complicit in this. And I'm also very concerned because apparently, and I don't know if this is a correct number or not, but apparently 24% of the federal budget now is going towards security in some form or another.
Mm-hmm.
Between DHS and federalizing the local police and building SWAT teams that are now breaking and entering into homes with small children.
Using military equipment.
And bad intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting it wrong more times than not. So we're out of control. So I don't know what the answer is. But I do believe that the answer is going to start in Vermont or Oregon or Hawaii.
Why is that?
I believe that we are going to break up as a country. I don't think the United States of America is sustainable in its present course.
Now, will it break like in socioeconomical lines, like East Coast, West Coast, Bible Belt? Or
no, well, there's two excellent books that I highly recommend. One is called The Nine Nations of North America. The other one's called The 11 Nations of North America. First off, I believe that Hawaii will secede from the Union. Mm-hmm. This is inevitable. It's already a matter of record in the U.S. congressional record that the United States government has admitted that it invaded and occupied Hawaii, and it essentially took it over.
Yeah, I mean, and it was a kingdom.
Yes, the stage is set for Hawaii to declare itself a restored kingdom. The stage is also set for Vermont to secede from the Union. I believe we will see a majority of legislators in Vermont within the next 3 to 4 years in favor of secession.
Mm-hmm.
Now, California has an initiative to break up into 6 states. I don't think that's realistic, but it would be good for California to break up into 3 states.
Mm-hmm. I've heard
X minus one is how many states could leave and still have 50 flags or 50 stars on the flag.
Uh-huh.
So if California breaks up into 3 states, if I were Hawaii and Vermont, I would say, I'm out of here, keep your 50 stars.
Mm-hmm. So you think that states will slowly succeed from the Union, and then what impact will that have in the government as a whole?
I'm also expecting a lot more nullification.
Mm-hmm.
I'm expecting states to begin nullifying government regulations. I'm expecting states to start taking a hard look, particularly in the West. I don't believe the federal government should own land. Mm-hmm. It should not control land.
Yeah.
Land is a state prerogative. We are the United States of America, not the United People of America.
Mm-hmm.
I also think we need to restore the practice of sending senators from states, not by public election. The states need to actually start representing themselves within the Congress at the Senate level.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the House should continue to represent the people, but there we need to get to tightly drawn districts that are actually representative of the public, and we need to have, I forget what the exact term of art is, but when I did my electoral reform thing with Occupy, people came out of the woodwork, and we've got an 11-point Electoral Reform Act online. And one of those acts calls for representatives for people who are distributed. So, for example, if you have a lot of libertarians distributed in a heavily Democratic state, those libertarians could still come together as a percentage of the population and have their own congressman.
So it's almost like you see in some other governments where you're not choosing the one person or the one party you want to win, you're choosing your top three, and then the government creates itself.
There are many ways to vastly improve the two-party tyranny that we mm-hmm. have now.
Now, if this doesn't take place, if states don't succeed, what changes on a grand scale do you see governmentally happening in the United States in the next 5, 10, 15 years?
I see a tax revolt, and I see possibly a general strike, a nonviolent general strike.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to paraphrase Lincoln, you can't screw all of the people all of the time. And that's where we're at right now.
Mm-hmm.
We are screwing all of the people all of the time.
But while people feel disadvantaged, and I'm sure that there's always someone doing slightly better than you, no one's... I mean, don't get me wrong, there are people that are starving, but we're not having bread riots like in ancient Greece or in France. I think if you're feeding the bare minimum of the population and they believe that they could become that 1%, how do you encourage them? How do they decide that they want to risk what they have to change everything?
That's a really good question, and I don't have all the answers. I do believe that bread riots are coming. The cost of food has skyrocketed.
Mm-hmm.
That
is something that, and you don't see that with inflationary numbers, because what they don't take into account is the huge scale, the factory farming that we do. Prices for food should have plummeted, but they've stayed relatively stationary. And I feel that in the grand scheme of things, in terms of inflation, right now people's rent is taking up, at least in this area, who knows out west, people's rent is taking up a majority of their money. But once food starts taking up a larger portion, but I mean, perhaps you will see those riots, but...
There's several aspects to this. The first is inflation is just completely out of control.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember 25-cent movies and 10-cent popcorn and 35-cent gallons of gas.
Yeah, but also back then, people were making $50 a week, not $500.
Yeah, you've got a lot of great points, but I don't think I'm talking to people who are lucky to be making $20,000 a year, and that's not enough to live on in New York City.
Definitely not.
Okay, so, but let's come back to food. Now, number one, the food is not healthy.
No,
most food today is not healthy.
At least the inexpensive food.
It's bad for you. It's fattening, and it's got toxins in it. But the other thing is that the true cost of mega agriculture, with particular reference to Monsanto and Roundup and all of these things, is you are killing the earth. You are literally going to go over the cliff and be unable to grow food at some point.
Mm-hmm.
We're also spending vastly too much money growing corn for everything except food.
Yeah.
And the corn is not edible. In fact, the cows don't even like it. So I think that we have lost the ability to think as a public. And you know, I was cheerful before I came in here, but now you've got me really depressed.
I'm sorry to burst your bubble.
No, it's not that you've burst my bubble. You've asked some very, very good questions, and if you come to Spy Improv, I hope you'll ask some more. But the bottom line here is I think that on the one hand, the Earth is an extraordinarily rich and diverse environment that can easily sustain a prosperous world at peace.
Mm-hmm.
6 billion people with plenty to eat, lots of shelter and everything. What has happened is that, at least for the 1 billion rich, we have financialized the economies. And we've become basically at least three economies. There's the digital economy, there's the land economy, and then there's the financial economy.
Okay.
And William Grider and John Bogle have both written books about the soul of capitalism. And one of the points that has been made is that land assets have appreciated about 5 times over the last 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Financial assets appreciated 17 times. So that, for me, tells me that 12 times of that appreciation is fraud, corruption,
mm-hmm.
crime, and the government is complicit in that crime. So a lot of this so-called wealth is fantasy wealth. It's digital wealth that is very, very good for the 1%, but it's doing absolutely nothing for the rest of us. It's not being invested.
Is it, though? Because let's say, like the 1960s, a calculator was an amazing piece of technology. Now, a cell phone is probably more technology than what they used to put
yes.
someone on the moon. And I could carry that around in my pocket for, you know, $200 up front and $100 a month.
Yes, now, and about 100 Chinese and leukemia wards.
True.
Because...
But that is a price that I don't see and I'll never see.
You're right. And that's a moral question that we should ask ourselves. Should we be okay with our smartphones basically doing a eugenics number on the Chinese? I'm sure Bill Gates would say he loves every bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
But for myself, I have to think that for every bad thing that is happening to the Chinese, there's at least another equal bad thing happening to us.
But how is what the Chinese going through much different than our own Industrial Revolution when we were basically an era of prosperity at the expense of the poorest
say
workers?
I would say scale, mm-hmm. both in terms of quantity and quality. The amount of toxins and...
Back then, there was only so much damage you
exactly
could do.
Exactly right.
Like... heavy metals,
and we're moving,
neurotoxins,
and I think
exist.
we're moving toward tipping points. I mean, one of the things that has impressed me enormously is the whole idea that diversity is a major contributor to innovation
mm-hmm.
and breakout. And when you look at the number of species that have been wiped out from the planet Earth, and when you look at the basic costs that we're imposing on the planet, what I see us doing is I see us narrowing our future and constraining our future. I'd like to see us do much more to honor the precautionary principle and to do no harm, as the physician's oath says.
I believe the tragedy of the commons, and until we start seeing those external costs, everyone's going to keep abusing them.
Well, that's part of the open source everything manifesto. The whole idea here is... I have 3 boys, and God willing, they will have children, and their children will have children, and they'll all live happily ever after. But the reality is that until people can see the true cost of everything that is being done in their name, they will not be responsible citizens. So part of my objective is to create an open source hub, a World Brain Institute, a global game in which true costs, I envision a handheld in which you look at a barcode and it tells you immediately with red, yellow, and green dots what the true cost is of that product in terms of water and child labor and so forth.
It's full impact on,
yes,
on the planet as a whole.
Exactly. And I envision a school of future-oriented hybrid governance, because it turns out the government is the stupidest of the eight information tribes. I think of the academic tribe, the civil society tribe, commerce, government, law enforcement, media, military, and non-government, non-profit. These are the eight big information groups.
Those are the groups that have the biggest impact.
Those are the groups that have the information.
Okay.
And those groups don't share information. They don't share information internally. They don't share information externally. If you look at the average book coming out of Harvard, I used to do citation analytics as part of my investigations. The average book coming out of Harvard cites Harvard people and occasionally someone from Stanford. It doesn't cite people from India and China and Brazil and Iran. So what we have here is a very incestuous, what Dick Clavin's Maps of Science calls a fragmented web. So we have increasingly more and more PhDs who know more and more about less and less, and they don't talk to each other. And so we've lost the ability to do holistic thinking. Let me give you a simple example from our favorite poster child for evil, the National Security Agency. They have created a computer processing center in Utah, which is a water-starved state. This processing center consumes 1.7 million gallons of clean water every single day. And in fact, the Utah legislation is now considering legislation to turn off the water. Okay, now if I had been director of NSA, apart from not violating the Constitution, I probably would have put that plant near the ocean.
Sure.
And had a water desalination plant as part of my construction. All right, so this is a simple example of a decision the U.S. government has made in our name and at our expense that is just totally insane.
Now, I think we're just about out of time. You have a talk tonight, I believe?
Tomorrow, Saturday at 11 o'clock.
At 11 o'clock.
And Spy Improv, Ask Me Anything.
Are you actually limited to amount of time this time, or is it going to go until
we've
it's done?
We've already set the world record at 8 hours and 1 minute.
You're not beating that now?
And now that I'm 62, although I feel 45, I think 2 hours is probably the outside limit, although I won't be averse to going to the side with a smaller group.
Now, in terms of content, is it going to be a straight 2-hour question and answer, or do you have an agenda too?
No, I don't have an agenda, but what I thought I would do is show my slides from the Liberation Technology briefing and just very quickly, without the words, go through the slides on the Open Source Everything Manifesto, and that'll take less than 10 minutes, and then we'll go into Q&A and I'm sure we'll have the usual 9/11 and JFK questions, and we can also talk about whether this Malaysian airliner in Ukraine was an Israeli covert action to distract attention from the genociding of Gaza.
I'm excited to hear that. I want to thank you for coming out. I appreciate you taking your time, and I just want to remind everyone that you're listening to Radio Statler. I think we'll be back soon. I forget who's up, but hang in there.